Then the fingertips of his left hand touched the rod. It felt warm and hard. Suddenly he knew which way was down. He fell. The touch had broken the spell. The webs of air around him snapped soundlessly, and he was plunging. He was close enough to the rod to seize it with one hand. The sudden checking of his fall brought his hip up against the rod with a painful impact. The skin of his hand burned as he slid down the rod, and then his other hand clutched the rod, and he had stopped. In front of him, on the other side of the rod, the bodies had started to fall. They descended with the velocity of a falling body on Earth, and each maintained its stretched-out position and the original distance between the body above and below. They even continued to revolve. It was then that the puffs of air on his naked, sweating back made him twist around on the rod. Behind him, in the vertical row of bodies that he had just occupied, the sleepers were also falling. One after the other, as if methodically dropped through a trapdoor, spinning slowly, they hurtled by him. Their heads missed him by a few inches. He was fortunate not to have been knocked off the rod and sent plunging into the abyss along with them. In stately procession they fell, body after body shooting down on both sides of the rod, while the other rows of millions upon millions slept on. For a while he stared. Then he began counting bodies. He had always been a devoted enumerator, but when he had counted 3,001, he quit. After that, he gazed at the cataract of flesh. How far up, how immeasurably far up were they stacked, and how far down could they fall? Unwittingly, he had precipitated them when his touch had disrupted the force emanating from the rod. He couldn't climb up the rod, but he could climb down it. He began to let himself down, and then he looked upward, and he forgot about the bodies hurtling by him. Somewhere, overhead, a humming was overriding the whooshing sound of the falling bodies. A narrow craft of some bright green substance and shaped like a canoe was sinking between the column of the fallers and the neighboring column of suspended. The aerial canoe had no visible means of support, he thought, and it was a measure of his terror that he didn't even think about his pun. No visible means of support. Like a magical vessel out of the 1001 Nights. A face appeared over the edge of the vessel. The craft stopped and the humming noise ceased. Another face was by the first. Both had long, dark, and straight hair. Presently the faces withdrew, the humming was renewed, and the canoe again descended toward him. When it was about 5 feet above him, it halted. There was a single small symbol on the green bow, a white spiral that exploded to the right. One of the canoe's occupants spoke in a language with many vowels and a distinct and frequently recurring glottal stop. It sounded like Polynesian. Abruptly, the invisible cocoon around him reasserted itself. The falling bodies began to slow in their rate of descent, and then stopped. The man on the rod felt the retaining force close in on him and lift him up. Though he clung desperately to the rod, his legs were moved up and then away, and his body followed it. Soon he was looking downward. His hands were torn loose. He felt as if his grip on life, on sanity, on the world had also been torn away. He began to drift upward and to revolve. He went by the aerial canoe and rose above it. The two men in the canoe were naked, dark-skinned as Yemenite Arabs and handsome. Their features were Nordic, resembling those of some Icelanders he had known. One of them lifted a hand, which held a pencil-sized metal object. The man sighted along it as if he were going to shoot something from it. The man floating in the air shouted with rage and hate and frustration and flailed his arms to swim toward the machine. "I'll kill!" he screamed. "Kill! Kill!" Oblivion came again. Chapter 2. God was standing over him as he lay on the grass by the waters and the weeping willows. He lay wide-eyed and as weak as a baby just born. God was poking him in the ribs with the end of an iron cane. God was a tall man of middle age. He had a long, black, forked beard, and he was wearing the Sunday best of an English gentleman of the 53rd year of Queen Victoria's reign. "You're late," God said. "Long past due for the payment of your debt, you know." "What debt?" Richard Francis Burton said. He passed his fingertips over his ribs to make sure that all was still there. "You owe for the flesh," replied God, poking him again with a cane. "Not to mention the spirit. You owe for the flesh and the spirit, which are one and the same thing."